Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit scientific and education organization whose scientists study the origin and nature of life. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to Genie in a Bottle. If you'd like to hear more Big Picture Science episodes, well, you'll find them in our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
If you're a podcast listener, but you prefer listening to over-the-air radio because your ancient genes never knew about the internet, well, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, consider letting them know that you like the show.
Oh, and if you listen by using iTunes, well, we invite you to leave a review about Big Picture Science on our iTunes page.
And to reach us directly with your comments, well, just tell us what's on your mind and email it to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
I'd be friends with the sparrows and the boy who shoots the arrows if I only had a heart.
Hey, this is Nigel.
This is The Dropout.
And you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Hey, there's a new talk show at 1 p.m. on the fifth Tuesday of the month. Foodies on the 5th introduces you to the food, facts, and faces of HFC's culinary program. Learn about HFC's culinary degree programs, the chefs, cooks, and teachers who make the program happen, and the great-tasting, healthy food available to the staff, students, and public. Tune in to Foodies on the 5th, the 5th Tuesday of the month. Hear the debut show at 1 p.m. Tuesday, March 29th. Remember, the show is podcast. Just go to Tuesday Talk on the WHFR webpage. That's WHFR.fm. Okay, and this is the 29th, and it is the premiere edition of Foodies on the 5th. Let's get started with a little bit of background here. There we go. Got it? See, just like you heard before. We are meeting with Chef Chris Jablonski today. Welcome to Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. And this is a pre-recorded show. The views and opinions expressed on Impact are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio nor Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves. Hi, I'm Lynn, your host, and today we're discussing the Henry Ford Culinary Program, also known on the fifth Tuesday of the month as Foodies on the 5th. And we're speaking with Chef Chris today, and he's going to tell us all about everything going on in HFCC Culinary. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, thank you, Lynn.
So, we're going to kind of get started with a, I'm not sure, I guess I would describe it as a the most background of background, getting into the culinary program. Tell us, pretty much, who are the main characters? Who are the chefs that make this whole program happen?
Well, Lynn, we've actually got six full-time instructors here in the department, mm-hmm. as well as approximately 18 part-time instructors that work with us. So the six full-time instructors are involved with maintaining the program and executing the major components of the program as we teach our students as understanding culinary arts. Our first lead person is actually Chef Eric Deckenbach. He's actually the program director as well as lead instructor for the department himself. And so just to give a little background about him, he was previously an executive chef at a Hilton Hotel in Buffalo, New York. And he's also a graduate of Schoolcraft College Culinary Arts Department, where I also graduated from. Mm-hmm. And he's also a certified executive chef and certified hospitality educator. And he does have a master's degree in marketing and business from Central Michigan University.
Okay. Are all the chefs involved in the program certified chefs?
Everybody's working on getting their certification completed.
If they don't have it already.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so for our chef de cuisine, which is Chef Joseph Crescenza, he's a certified executive chef as well as a certified hospitality educator. He studied at the Le Cordon Bleu School in Chicago, got his culinary arts degree training out there, and then he went on to get his bachelor's degree in Madison, Wisconsin, if I remember correctly. So he was actually at Winona University, which is actually outside of St. Paul, Minnesota. And he was previously executive chef at Biga Restaurant in Southfield and Royal Oak. So he helped to establish both of those restaurants in the metropolitan Detroit area. But he's also trained and worked throughout the country at very high elite restaurants in his training. Mm-hmm. So he's our chef de cuisine of our restaurant operation today here at the college.
And from a titling point of view, what does that mean so far as job responsibilities?
Well, he's responsible for all the food in the restaurant, as well as writing the menus, as well as passing down information to all the other staff members below him, such as myself, as well as the hot food chefs and all the executive chefs that are below him. So he's in charge of the operations of the restaurant, writing the menus for the presentation to the public, and being able to see how things are flowing and if there's any problems to make the decisions about changing things as they go along.
Okay.
Then we also have Chef Jeffrey Click. He's a certified hospitality educator. He's one of our mainstays people. When I say this, he's in all positions of the kitchen. Not only does he do baking, but he also does hot food prep work. So he's a float-around person. He's in between everybody else. So he's falling between Chef Joe and myself as being executive pastry chef here at the college. And so he's a main person that's been with the college for over 13 years. He graduated from this department, and then he went out and worked at operations like Opus One as a pastry assistant out there. But he also has his degree as a certified hospitality educator, and he has a bachelor's degree from Siena Heights University, so he's part of the restaurant management degree program over there. Our manager of the restaurant, in the sense of the front of the house operations, is Lauren Wallace, and she's also a certified hospitality educator. She has her degrees in marketing from the International Hospitality School in Chicago. And she has the responsibility of interacting with the guests daily in the restaurant and see how they like the food and how things are going, and if there's any questions or concerns and so forth. And she's also part of our marketing program here at the college to help market the restaurant to the public itself. So she's responsible for our websites and so forth and getting the information out there. Chef Dawn Marie Camille, who's one of our hot food chefs in the evening hours on Thursday nights, who does the dinners for Thursday night dinners. She's also a nutritional instructor here at the college. She also graduated from Schoolcraft College in Culinary Arts, but then she went on to finish up her nutritional training degree at Eastern Michigan University. So she's responsible for doing all the finishing work on Thursday evening with the students on the front line for the hot food side of the kitchen, and she does all our nutritional teaching classes for us. So she's definitely involved with us, even helping us design our menus so they're nutritionally balanced out and that our students have a good understanding what it means to cook food properly. Okay. Then we have Chef Jeffrey Lau, who is a certified ice carver, a certified culinarian, certified hospitality educator, and he is our lead ice carving instructor here at the college. And he just recently finished up his master's degree in education. Okay, so he's one of our major players. He's active with the Ice Carving Club. He's our advisor to the Ice Carving Club, as well as being involved with Garmager here at the college, teaching the art of the cold kitchen, as we call it, understanding how to prepare foods, utilizing underutilized cuts of meats, and creating beautiful items with those techniques. Just recently, one of his great exposures that he just did was about 3 weeks ago, he was in Fairbanks, Alaska for the International Ice Carving Competition, and he was working with four other ice carvers from the Midwest area, and they took a third place medal in the world. So he had a great time up there, and he came back and he's really talked it up. He's been asked to go back up to Fairbanks, Alaska to carve ice again next year.
That's pretty impressive.
Very much so.
How many visitors were there? You talk about worldwide.
If I remember correctly, there was 25 or 26 different teams up there.
Okay.
And what they were carving was what they classified as lake ice. So these were blocks of ice. From my understanding, what Jeff was telling me, that the sculpture that they worked on was 10,000 pounds or 10 tons of ice in the air. And it was, they called it El Bula. It was a large bull that was blowing steam out of its nostrils, and quite unique that they maxed out the crane to lift up the ice when they were putting it on display.
Oh my gosh.
So for them to go up there and have that opportunity, it's a great exposure.
Definitely.
Very much so. Okay. And then for myself, I'm the pastry chef instructor here. I'm also certified as a hospitality educator. And I have my bachelor's degree with hotel restaurant management from Siena Heights University also. And for myself, I've traveled all over the world competing and representing not only myself, but also the college throughout the world. So it's a good group of students, good group of employees that we work with and staff members that make this program go and take it to the next level.
And those classified as cooks, the ones who are actually getting the food out there that we eat when we go to the 5101 restaurant, those are students.
Those are actual students. Mm-hmm. Those are our students that are in training, and they can range any for age from anywhere from 18 years old to 60 years old, if not older. And all these folks are here to either start a new career or do a second career and take themselves on to a new level. So they are getting exposed to not only cooking the food, but also presenting it, but also having to wait on the tables and interact with people on a daily basis. So the fact is for our program, we try to balance it out so that our students are well-rounded in all aspects of the hospitality industry, not only in the sense of the culinary arts side of the program, but also involved with management side. So if they decide not to become a culinary, like a chef, they want to go and run a restaurant, or they want to run a hotel or a country club or manage a catering operation, they have that knowledge base so they can get themselves going forward.
Wow. Okay, we talked about the executive level and the various functions, various duties that apply to those individuals. What about the student? You meant students in general. You mentioned that they have to learn front of the house, back of the house, that sort of thing, how to cook and how to serve, et cetera, et cetera. Could you give us a rundown on those jobs?
Sure. What we do is throughout our program, in the sense of saying, if our student starts our program at the beginning, and they are for their first semester within the operation, we suggest that they take on a job with the industry in the sense of being, could be a prep cook position, could be a basic position, basic skill set, so they get an understanding of what this industry is about. As they go further into our program, in the sense of saying it's a 2.5-year program, they are asked to move up through the rankings. So eventually, by the time they graduate, they should be able to pull down a position of being a sous chef or an executive sous chef, which is the one person directly below the executive chef. And as a student, we encourage them to go ahead and experience the industry so that they can see what the industry is all about. Many people have the idea of that the industry is fun and exciting and that, oh, they're going to make the big bucks walking out the door. But in reality, it's an industry where you start at the bottom and work your way up. And it's experiencing those different levels of work experience that you're able to become more comfortable with taking on more responsibility. Because not only as a chef do we have to understand how to cook food, but we also have to go ahead and have a very good knowledge of how to go ahead and run money, maintain our finances, maintain our food, so the fact that we're servicing good quality food to our guests, and making sure that we're properly cooking it, maintaining it, and presenting it properly to our guests. And that's a challenge for many students to realize, that they think, oh, I see all these great cooking shows out on the TV stations, and that's what they want to do. And then they don't realize, being an entrepreneur, being a person that owns a food truck, they're like, oh, great, food trucks are going all over the country. But there's a lot more responsibility than just driving a truck into a spot and saying, here's my food, present it. Mm-hmm. As a chef, as an owner, as an entrepreneur, that's a job that's 356 days a year. So for us, holidays are tough because we're all time working. And our holidays are off days when nobody's around and we can actually settle down. But our holidays are when we don't actually have a holiday that most people recognize.
Right, right. So far as serving goes, how does the training go? Because I know the dining room itself looks lovely when you walk in. I noticed last week there were two different colors of napkins with two different folds. Mm-hmm. So obviously the napkin folding is part of it, place
very
setting is
so.
Part of it. Blade side goes in and all that business, right?
Correct, correct. They're okay. Formally, the students are formally trained on how to properly set up a dining room table. Could be as a sense of saying a formal menu. In the sense that, let's say it's a 7-course meal, you'll be trained in understanding how to set a 7-place course table arrangement, where you actually eat from the outer edge of the table to the inner edge to your plate zone. Mm-hmm. And then you may have 7 different sets of glassware going along with it too. So in the sense of saying that is traditional style, but there's multiple styles of cuisine to think about in setting a table. Mm-hmm. Family style, Russian style, French style, German style. There's all these different styles of cuisines as well as table arrangements that mean different things in setting up. If you're doing a very formal dinner, you may have 7 different plates on presentation and 7 different sets of silverware. Every course that you receive, you would utilize 1 set of silver, and then that silver is removed and taken out of view. And then the table would be crumbed and cleaned and so forth and arranged so that literally, I can take it back to, if anybody watched lately the show Downton Abbey, and the example of the butler setting the formal dining room table for the family, that is how stringent many formal restaurants are, where literally it is one thumbnail away from the edge, and the silver is lined from right to left, or say left to right and so forth on the table, so that people have an understanding that, yes, you work your way from the outside into the table arrangements, and then you may have silver in the top side of your plate, and you're like, what is that for? And that would be used for coffee service or dessert services. So again, the students are exposed to that knowledge so that they can not only, if they don't feel comfortable stepping into a regular family-run restaurant and they want to go to a high-end restaurant, that they can actually feel comfortable into that environment.
Mm-hmm. What kind of background do you need to begin the culinary program as a student?
You really don't need to have a background. We ask that you basically have math skills and writing skills and communication skills.
Okay.
That's one of the biggest issues that I think for many of our students. They're scared to talk to people because of the new generation being so technologically connected to a computer that they don't carry forth the understanding of being able to stand in front of somebody and say, hi, how are you doing? And give them the warm welcome to so that they feel comfortable in their environment that they're coming into and be able to feel out their customers and be able to either help upsell a dessert item or a menu item or be able to get a sense of what the customer wants because they may have a dietary need or restriction. And so as a student and a future culinarian, they have to also understand what is in the food. So if there's any questions, they can answer those questions right in front of those guests without mm-hmm. having to run back to the chef and say, what's in this menu item?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As of January of 2016, Henry Ford now offers a four-year degree in culinary.
Correct.
And without, I can do the math, mm-hmm. but without stating the obvious, what is the difference between a two-year culinary degree and a four-year culinary degree?
Well, in the sense of saying that in the two-year culinary degree, the students are getting their associate's degree, and they can step out in the industry and take on any job they'd like to take on. But as going on to getting to a bachelor's degree, it aligns the student more in line to becoming more of a managerial position. Instead of stepping in and taking on a cooking position, they may take on the executive chef's position instead of being a prep cook. And so with the new degree, we're trying to finish rounding out our students so that they have a better understanding of entrepreneurship, as well as business management, as well as understanding if you're going to take on the opportunity of becoming an entrepreneur, what are your requirements as an entrepreneur to handle yourself in the workforce? Because not only as an entrepreneur do you have to worry about putting out product to your guests, but now you may have to hire in people. And what are your responsibilities with the laws with taking on people as employees?
Mm-hmm.
How to file taxes, how to maintain your books. It's not just the fact that, oh, I want to cook. There's a lot more responsibility in being your own personal entrepreneurial staff.
Right. 5101 in general has a really, really good reputation, and it has been around for quite some time. How long does it go back?
It actually was opened in 1972.
I'm not sure what that was grammatically.
The program itself was started in 1972, and originally it was known as the Gate Room. So the connection to that name was the fact that it was named for in honor of the name of the college, Henry Ford College. Now, Henry Ford College, originally Henry Ford Community College. But the fact was this was originally part of Henry Ford's private estate. And on the estate, near the Fairlane Estate in the University of Michigan Dearborn campus, there is a set of iron gates. And it was known as the Gate Room in the sense of opening up to Mrs. Ford's private rose garden. So I think that's where that connection came back to our first original name, the Gate Room.
Mm-hmm.
And 13 years ago, they upgraded the restaurant, they upgraded the department, and they changed the name to be known as 5101, which is the name of, and street address of the college.
Right.
So from my understanding, talking to people here on campus, I asked, why did they name it the 5101? And the concept was that they wanted to sound like Fifth Avenue. You know, 1/5th Avenue, well, 5101 Evergreen Road. So it was quite unique that the name came about that way, and it stuck with us so far. And it's, again, representation of the fact that we are a Dearborn College, and we are very much supportive of our Dearborn community, and we love our support of our Dearborn community helping us out with this restaurant and our facilities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know I've seen some school board members and what have you, and they're on a pretty regular basis.
Very much so.
Yeah. There are still people that I'll hand out one of the flyers, and it's like I've never been there.
Right.
I didn't know it existed. And the name is, I think, getting out there a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Things like this would help
certainly.
The world know about it.
Certainly.
But,
certainly. I think what's happening right now is we are trying to put ourselves out there more and more into the community to recognize that we are part of this community and it's open to the public. Mm-hmm. One of our statements that we send back to all of our students when they start the semester is we send home a personal letter to all their members, in the sense of saying their immediate family, their spouses, their significant others, and so forth. And the letter's addressed that way to come and eat my homework. And so for many of the people that come in, they're like, I'm here to eat my daughter's homework. And we're like, well, what are we talking about? And it's because of the fact that we've invited the family members to come and realize that if it wasn't for the family or their friends or their significant others or so forth, that these students would not be here. Mm-hmm. And so for many students, it's that secondary support system that we recognize to say, thank you for giving these students that opportunity to come in here and learn something new and have them realize that this may be their dream. Mm-hmm. And we want to be supportive of them as well as helping the community support them, and to have them realize that, hey, this is quite unique to have that opportunity, no matter what age you are, to come back to school and get an education. So for some students, it may be a second time around in education, and they're trying to realign themselves so that they do have a better career ahead of themselves. Mm-hmm. And so for them to come back to school, and they may be in their mid-40s, and guess what? They're married with children. Next thing you know, we have their families coming to school. Mm-hmm. And their children start getting interested in coming to college. So when they get old enough, they're like, this is where I want to start my education. Because for some students, starting out at a four-year academic arena is tough, and they don't make it. And so they have to come back down to the community level and realize, get your basic core classes done here, then you can transfer up if you want to. Or with now, with us having our bachelor's degree, you don't even have to leave our campus. You can stay right here on campus and complete it with us right here.
Yeah. Wow. Lots.
Lots is happening.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so you're sending out the letter and you're inviting the families to come in or whomever. There's signage on the building.
Yep.
We have flyers around campus when special events happen, like the two bake sales per year, that
That's
sort
right.
of thing. You have special dinners, thematic dinners a couple times per year. Does the 5101 reach out to other venues where we're talking about off campus, where you go to some sort of a fair or that kind of thing?
We do participate in the Dearborn Farmers Market every year. Actually, twice a year we do it. We do it in October, and then we do one in the spring months.
Okay.
Last spring, what we did for the presentation was we actually did create a vegetarian sandwich. And for many people, they looked at me like, why are we doing vegetarian? I said, because that's how society is slowly changing. We're starting to realize we're starting to get away from some of those meat products, but we're also realizing keep something quite simple but quite delicious. And so we actually did a garlic aioli with roasted vegetables on a nice whole wheat baguette, and it turned out beautifully because of the fact that we actually grilled them on a char-grilled fire. So we got a real nice flavor to them, and then we layered it all together, which was zucchini, peppers, tomatoes, onions, and so forth, all layered together with a nice aioli, and then we stacked it. We served it out to our clientele at the farmers market, and the farmers market is quite popular. Mm-hmm. And when they see the college come out, they're quite supportive of us to come over and see what's going on. They check to see what our menus are looking like, if we're going to be open, when are we opening for the spring semester, how long are we going to be open, what restaurant, what themes are we running in the restaurant. And it gets the community to realize that we're here. Mm-hmm. For mm-hmm. so many people in Dearborn, it's the same thing when I worked over at the Henry Ford Estate. It was known as the Diamond in Dearborn because nobody knew it existed. Mm-hmm. It was tucked away from the view. And I feel that's the same thing here at the college mm-hmm. with our restaurant. We're tucked in a central building, but we don't have that prime exposure that most people would see on the roadbed of many restaurants.
Right.
And so you can drive right by campus and not realize there's a student-run restaurant right in the middle of the building, so right in the middle of the campus. So by putting our name out into those special events, as well as examples of doing community events, like tomorrow evening we'll be going out to the Girl Scout cookie competition at the DT Energy headquarters and putting ourselves out there. If we take a prize, if we don't take a prize, we usually get a written-up article about us. And so that puts us out into more newspaper exposure, saying, hey, guess what, we're here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're moving forward, and the department's moving forward. The quality of education is going up, and our students are coming out a lot stronger. So for them, it's a benefit to putting our name out there. And we involve our students in all those activities because, in fact, it gives them the opportunity to see what it might mean to do a off-site catering operation. Or we might be asked to go and do a dinner down at Eastern Market, as an example, where the Eastern Market Business Association last fall hosted an event, and Chef Joe and the students were involved with it, and they did a phenomenal job. It was also featured in the Our Detroit magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact is, it's getting our students to realize that it's not only the knowledge that you have, but it's also the networking ability to understand and communicate to people,
mm-hmm.
say, hey, how can we get out there and get more exposure? and be able to give ourselves some positive exposure that really showcases to the community that we're doing great things here at the college.
And we've talked a lot about the quality of the food, a little bit about the variety of the food, mm-hmm. and the fact that the students are making it. But, you know, there's that thing called the bottom line. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. That is not an – it's five-star food at a, what, a minus-star price?
Well, I could say it this way. It's caviar dreams on a beer budget belly.
Yeah.
That's how it really is. And I think what happens is, as all the chefs, we are very conscious of what we're spending our – what we're spending the money on. And being able to create good meals and good technology, teaching good teaching techniques in food so that people have an understanding. You don't have to buy the best meat to turn out a great meal, but it's also understanding what are you buying into? Mm-hmm. Where are you getting food, you know, your food from? Where are you requiring your basic ingredients is from? And that's a big thing that's occurring now in the community, not only in the chefing industry, but all over this country. Chefs are becoming more interested in what they call a farm-to-fork philosophy. They're getting to know the farmers. Where are the pigs being raised? Where are the cattle being raised? Are they being raised in a humane manner? Are the chickens being, you know, farm-raised in the sense of saying, left out to go out and nibble on grass? Or are they penned up in a room where all they do is feed them corn all day long? Mm-hmm. So for many of us, not only as chefs, but also our public, are getting more educated as to where food is coming from. Mm-hmm. How is it being processed? Is it good for us? Is it bad for us? So we have to stay on top of that as instructors to keep abreast of what's going on in the industry and be able to keep fostering those relationships of working on getting good quality food in our operation. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we're working on here at the campus is we have our own herb garden going, so we're cutting fresh herbs. And to see our students go out with our instructors, it becomes now an extended laboratory. So now it's not only the kitchen, but now we take them outdoors and say, here's where this comes from. I just recently heard on the TV this morning, I was watching a show, they talked about how a gentleman was showcasing how to save seeds, and it was sunflower seeds, and one of his students that was with him said, I thought sunflower seeds came in a plastic bag from the grocery store.
Oh.
Not realizing that they actually grew on a plant and that they had to get processed off the plant. But for some of our, you know, for some students, that's their knowledge. Ask them where the chocolate milk comes from. It comes from a chocolate cow. No, it's white milk with cocoa powder added into it. And so getting our students to recognize where do things really come from, mm-hmm. because we've drifted away from having our own private gardens and getting used to going to the grocery stores and acquiring things, but we don't realize where they're actually coming from.
Go back two steps when we were talking about, obviously, the cost to me as a diner mm-hmm. Is based on what you're paying for the foods. And
correct.
You're telling me that you are shopping wisely, growing things yourself, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Bottom line for, because people may not understand, because like I said, you look in that door and it's a beautiful restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about something under $10 for the most part.
Correct.
And you're talking about multi-course.
Correct.
And when that plate comes out, the final plate comes out, you have basically you have a protein and a starch and a vegetable of mm-hmm. some sort. But prior to that, there's some wonderful soup and
certainly.
There's a salad bar that is absolutely incredible.
Certainly.
So for not too much money.
No.
But then you also talked about the herbs. What herbs are you growing?
Well, we're going to be starting again. Right now we've got English thyme coming up. We've got French tarragon already up on the field. I just checked, our rhubarb is already ready to come in, so it's running pretty fast already, but I'm a little concerned because we're supposed to be getting snow in the next week or so.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
Cold weather again.
Yeah.
And so as a chef, I might have to come over and cover everything up just to protect it from not getting frosted out again, because we're in that temperamental change that mm-hmm. things are starting to run and starting to grow, and when you pick fresh herbs right off the field, the flavor is phenomenal. It doesn't sit around in a grocery store on a shelf for 2 or 3 days and the flavor goes away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Cutting fresh thyme and putting it right into our soups, that changes the whole flavor composition. Cuts out the salt, because we don't need to have salt in those recipes then. And so flavors become more intensified, and reducing things and taking natural reductions of items, the flavors are more intensified. So the fact is, that's how we're getting our quality of our cuisine to become much better than where we were at. And for many people, they start looking at us and go, what do you mean you're cutting fresh herbs? Yeah, it's our educational aspect of bringing our students to realize, hey, guess what? You can grow this stuff and you can grow in your backyard. And so it's impacting our students to realize they're now going home and setting up their own little gardens at home, or they're talking to their churches or their community centers and they're establishing small community gardens. And it's slowly changing the whole diversity of their communities to realize, guess what? It takes one person. But once one person sets that seed, it could grow into a bigger project. The next thing you know, everybody in the community is supporting. And next thing you know, you've got young children coming up and say, hey, can I grow an apple tree? Sure, we can. And next thing you know, you're having to pick those apples and have them realize, hey, it's fresh produce. Mm-hmm. And for many people, that's not available at this point. And so for our students to get that as an example, they go back and start planting those ideas. And next thing you know, their communities start getting a lot stronger.
Right. Right. You going to try anything new in the herb garden that you haven't tried before?
I'm probably going to bring in one of my bay laurel trees, which is bay leaf. It's a perennial shrubbery. It can grow up to 6.5 to 8 feet in height. Mm-hmm. And once it gets going, it'll be kept in a pot. So it'll be moved out during the summer months and then moved back in for the winter months, as well as rosemary. I was quite successful this past winter protecting 3 rosemary bushes over from last fall. So I dug them up before the cold hit them, brought them indoors, kept them on a drier side, kept them under bright lights, and they're going to be going back out. And we'll have 2 to 3 year old rosemary bushes now that we'll be able to turn into cuttings and multiply them and make hedgerows out of them. Mm-hmm. So understanding what products, what vegetables, what herbs we can carry across in the seasons, the next thing you know, we'll have it all the time. Like fresh rhubarb, right now it's premium priced, but picking it fresh out of a field doesn't cost us much.
And isn't that pretty weed-like? Doesn't it just grow?
Oh, it does grow. It does multiply.
Yeah.
I know when ours will finally leaf out, it'll be 6 feet in diameter.
Wow.
So that's a big, big old rhubarb root. Mm-hmm. And over time, you have to eventually keep splitting those apart. Mm-hmm. I read a story recently about a farmer in Ohio that his family worked with a farming family that grew rhubarb. And every year, they would harvest it. And gentlemen, the farmer got up to the age where he passed away. But in his will, he left the rhubarb behind for the next family to enjoy. And they started out with one plant. They now have over 7,000 plants of rhubarb planted out. So they've named it as their farmer's name, their previous farmer's name, rhubarb, and that's what they sell it as.
Wow.
So to carry on that tradition and carry those varieties of vegetables and fruits and produces forward, people don't realize we are losing our stock of seeds in this world quite effectively, more and more every day. And we're getting less and less produce variety out there. Mm-hmm. And so, as an example, apples. You can go to the grocery store, you might see 10 or 12 different varieties of apples sitting on the table, but there's over 6,000-7,000 varieties of apples available throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And we don't see a lot of those produce items because of the fact that they've been lost over time. Maybe a farmer had a crop and they've lost it, or they've passed away and somebody came through, bought up the land and cut out the trees and said, that's it, they're gone. Mm-hmm. So the fact is the varieties that we see on the market are being produced for production, but many farmers are starting to go back to old varieties, what they call heirloom variety vegetables, and replanting those seeds and bringing those varieties back to life, which have the true flavors in them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
and I don't see a downside because you have things growing. Mm-hmm. You're harvesting these things. You don't have to replant these things, especially like the rhubarb.
Correct.
And then you're selling it in the restaurant.
That's right.
It's win-win.
That's right. That's right.
And you talk about, you know, farm to fork. Mm-hmm. This is yard to fork.
Literally yard to fork. It's 2 or 3 yards off the buildings.
Parking lot to fork.
That's right.
All right. Let's talk about the program with the students. And you had mentioned that they can come in basically with a high school education. They can come in and get started and aim for whatever certification, degree, or degree they're looking for.
That's right.
If somebody is coming in and just interested in doing this as either continuing ed or some sort of more of a hobby, more of the love of the food kind of thing, is that acceptable too?
It is acceptable, but we encourage them to go on in the sense of staying within the department. Mm-hmm. They just can't pop in and take one class and then go out on their own again. We encourage them to go through the procedural steps of taking all the classes so that they can either walk out. If they want to get a certificate, we do offer certificate programs also. But if they follow through, they can go and finish out with an associate's degree in culinary arts, then finish with a secondary associate degree in hotel restaurant management. And if they want to continue on, they can finish out with their bachelor's degree in hotel restaurant management also. So there's four or five different opportunities throughout their experience that they can get exposure to this industry. Mm-hmm. And for some people, it might be they just come back in and do a little touch-up on their skill level. Okay. As an example, sanitation classes. Everybody that comes through has to take that course. That's one of the prerequisites to start the program. You have to have sanitation underneath your belt. Mm-hmm. And that is kept on record for 5 years. Every 5 years, you have to renew it. And so for the fact is, for many of our students, they will graduate in that short amount of time, and they're out in the world, and they're like, oh, my certification's up again, so I got to come back to the college and recertify it. And so they come back in, take the class, recert again for another 5 years. And that proves to you that when you walk into a restaurant, you look at the walls, and you see certifications hanging on the wall. Who's certified about sanitation and nutrition? Mm-hmm. And that's important to recognize, because for many facilities, you might not see that ever on the wall, and you wonder, are they really cooking food properly?
Right, right.
Are they cooking in a clean environment? Am I actually getting a good quality meal from these folks?
So is Henry Ford actually working with the county on this?
Well, it's actually a state mandated as well as federal mandated law.
Okay.
That we actually, it's called the National Restaurant Association. They're the ones that are initiating this program. And so for culinary students, we ask that all of our culinary students that come through this program be certified. And so as they graduate, on the other side of the flip of the coin, they'll be certified as a certified sanitation specialist. But they'll also land up, if they graduate and leave our program and they finished up with their associate's degree, they can apply through the American Culinary Federation for a certified culinary position or a certified culinary labeling. So there are multiple different levels they can walk in there also. Mm-hmm. So leaving us and graduating us, they can have their CC title on their name. And that helps to open up the doors to many of the finer restaurants and facilities throughout the metropolitan Detroit area, and even throughout southeastern Michigan or throughout the country.
Wow.
So it's the opening of the doors. And then if they stay in the industry and continue on, they can eventually apply for a certified sous chef position, or even go on to become a certified executive chef.
There are... there are clubs, which I presume are supposed to be like the fun part of learning how
Certainly.
To do some of these things. The ice carving club.
And I mean, the baking club.
That's a riot. You can use a chainsaw, you use an iron, you use all kinds of household Sure. tools to carve the ice. And then there's a baking club.
Correct.
Is that it?
Those are the two clubs that we've right now
Okay.
Established in the culinary arts department.
Okay.
As part of the ice carving club, as an example, you have to take a safety test. You know, to use that chainsaw, you have to understand how to handle it.
That's probably a really good idea.
You don't want to cause injuries or cause yourself injuries or cause injuries to other people. So there are safety tests that you have to take, including even in the baking side of the program. We have to take a safety test and sanitation test just to make sure that you understand what it means to work in a facility and understand what type of sanitation do you have to maintain. Because
okay.
we are doing events for the public. As an example, tomorrow evening we're doing the Girl Scouts competition.
Mm-hmm.
We do the parade company in October, where they invite us to go down and do the preview party for the parade company. So we do food for 900 people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here at the restaurant at the college, we might do a couple hundred people in a week. And if we do a special event, such as like a St. Patrick's Day buffet or an Oktoberfest, we might have 200-300 people in one day.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact is, it gives those opportunities for the students to realize what volume cookery is at and
mm-hmm.
what does it mean to do that. A good example would be cooking for dinner for 10,000 people at Cobo Hall for, let's say, the NAACP dinner, where you've got 10,000 people dinner at one time. That's a lot of food to put out at one time,
oh,
and you've
yeah.
got to consider what kind of staff you've got to put together for that event, and that's a one-night event.
Mm-hmm.
So you may be prepping food for a week to get ready for that event, and then in 3 hours, all that food is gone. So to understand that kind of volume cookery, if they wanted to go work out in Vegas or work out in Chicago or New York, work in some of the premium properties, they could be doing dinners for 10,000, 20,000 people a day.
Wow.
And that's a lot of food being processed by the human hand
oh, absolutely.
And be able to manage things the proper way,
yeah.
too.
Yeah. Wow. You mentioned the numbers for some of the special dinners.
Mm-hmm.
What about just any Wednesday, Thursday night? How many seats is in the dining room?
The restaurant itself, in? The dining room itself, in the 5101, if I remember correctly, it's about 75 seats,
okay.
Seating capacity. But then we flip that multiple times in the evening.
Sure.
So we could have 150 people for a nightly dinner.
Mm-hmm.
We're open Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays for lunch hours
mm-hmm.
from 11:30 to 1:30. And then on Wednesday and Thursday evening, we're open from 6 o'clock until 7:45. So there's short amounts of window time, but we're an educational facility, so our guests have to realize we're school. And it's their opportunity to come in and become the testers of the food, but the evaluators of the staffs. So the fact is, interacting with the students, give them that opportunity to realize what it means to go into a restaurant environment, because as a wait staff member, you have to integrate yourself with those people and intermingle with them. Treat them with respect, they'll treat it respect back to you, and make them feel comfortable. So for many people, they may come up to you and say, what do you recommend, chef? What do you recommend this for me? You know, I'm on a special diet, what can I have? You know, or I can't have gluten, or I can't have sodium in my diet for the time being. What can you prepare for me? So having our students integrate into that philosophy and understand what it's all about. We get some students that are natural at it, that just step in and have fun with it, and other ones that are, you know, scared to step out of that arena and realize, but once they get into it, they're like, okay, I enjoy this. It's not something I got to be scared about. And to have them realize the guests that we're servicing are guests that are familiar with us, and they know what we're about. They understand we're a culinary school. And so they give us a little break once in a while with some of the issues, but they let us know about it. We address it with our students so they realize, hey, this is some of your mistakes you're making, and this is how you're going to correct them.
And it, I think it goes the other way, too. People who may not dine out often may be a little bit uncomfortable, intimidated.
Sure.
They might be a little bit intimidated by various types of forks, you know, what, where do I start? You know, and I might not know I need to start from the outside and work in.
That's right.
So are the students trained that way, too, to
certainly
make the people comfortable?
Certainly. They're actually taught to warm them up. You know, it may be just a simple compliment to a guest that breaks the ice. It might be, let's say the customer cracks a joke, be able to take that joke and be able to enjoy it and be, you know, not insulted by them, but realize, guess what? We're just trying to break the ice between us. And become comfortable. Because the fact for many students, it's their first time in front of the public and integrating themselves and talking with people. Because for many students, they don't have that opportunity. They're scared to doing it. They've got their own little niche of people that they deal with on a daily basis. And that's it. And so they don't want to venture out of that comfort zone. And for them, it's uncomfortable. But once they go through it a couple times, they're like, okay, I can handle this. I'm okay. And on top of that, Lynn, in the restaurant, we actually, in the evening hours, we also have a wine service. So we actually service alcohol, beer and wine, in the evening hours at the restaurant. And so again, for the students, they have to realize what wines pair with what items that are on the menu and make recommendations. Because a guest may come in and say, well, I want a glass of wine. Or I'm having a party, can I get a bottle of wine for the table? And certainly, how do you pour it? How do you service it? You know, there are certain techniques to doing that presentation in front of public to make them feel comfortable and say, here's our wine that I recommend, and this is the undernotes that I have on it. And say, okay, that's a good quality wine, I'll go ahead and buy a bottle from you. Or I'll take a glass of it and let's try it out. You know, and next thing you know, they may come back next week and say, oh yeah, we were here last week, we want this wine again. They remember that, because that's a big challenge for even as a server to recognize your regular customers. Because the next thing you know, you're not just saying good afternoon or good evening, welcome to the 5101 restaurant. You're actually going, good evening, Lynn. I'd like to welcome you to the 51, and we already have your seating arrangement set up for you. You might say, I have guests coming with me, and how many do you have coming? Two or three, boom, 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 and it's all arranged for you. So it makes you feel more comfortable.
Does your stock of beer and wine change?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes, it does, especially the beer side of the program. We change the beer as to depending on the season, as well as also what themes we've got going through the restaurant. So we may be having, say, for St. Patrick's Day, we had a lot of Irish stouts on the menu, as an example, just to bring about those flavors of those beers within the operation itself. So we've changed as we go along. We have a standardized stock, but then we specialize a few items also into it. So it may be that during October, when the beers are starting to change, the flavors are changing with the seasons.
Talk about both of those menu items as it relates to food and as it relates to the beer wine side, where you do have a standard, if you will, menu. Half the menu is standard, and then the other half varies by some sort of theme.
Okay.
Explain the themes.
Well, we've got a standardized menu, which are standardized items that we carry on every menu throughout the course of the 12 weeks that we're open to the public. And then we have, every week, we have a different themed menu going out in the restaurant itself. So we have specialty items that are offered every week. be an entree item, be a vegetarian item, be a pork item, a beef item, and fish item, and so forth. And we change it. Same thing with our dessert menu. Our dessert menu changes to everything that we have in the restaurant. So we've got 12 different themes that we present. And this week, we're offering our Northern Italian menu. Next week will be contemporary French. So the fact is, every week our menu changes. We have a cycling menu and our standardized menu. Mm-hmm. So for some people, they'll come in and say, I want what's standardized. They're mm-hmm. used to that. But then other people will turn around and say, well, I want something different. What do we have for the themed menus?
Right, right.
So we put out different items every week for mm-hmm. a theme. And that gives our students an opportunity to experience different cuisines throughout the world without leaving the neighborhood. You know, so if they right. go one weekend, it's German weekend, and the week after that might be Polish weekend, and so forth, or the Caribbean. So we're changing all of our themes all the time, and it exposes our students to a variety of food that they might not otherwise have ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Very briefly, a lot of times you hear about Northern Italian or what have you. Explain the difference between Northern Italian and Southern Italian.
There's Northern Italian and Southern Italian. The true difference between the two is when you think about the country of Italy itself. Southern Italy is more of a tropical region, so you're going to see more citrus, you're going to see more seafood-based items, compared to Northern Italy, which is more of a mountainous region area. So you're going to see more dairy product on the menu. You're also going to see a lot more beef appearing on the menu. Some of the techniques that we're utilizing within the restaurant are what we classify as sous vide, is where we're actually searing off meat and then we're cryovacking it, which is sealing it into a bag and then basting it in a warm water bath, but all the flavors are there. Hmm. And it's a long, slow process, so the meat literally falls off the bone and it's tender and it's juicy, it's not overcooked. And so Chef Joe has been the one that's been really pushing those ideas forward. And some of the food is just phenomenal. I mean, one of his signature sauces is a pomodoro sauce. We're making our own in-house pastas right now. So it gives our students to realize, guess what? You can make pasta by hand. Mm-hmm. And Joe's following his family roots. He's going back to remembering when his grandmother and his uncle were running restaurants in New York.
Wow.
And so he says, I can remember as a young child growing up, and I'd go visit my grandmother, and she had me rolling pasta. So it's bringing back memories for him to realize, guess what? We all have those family bloodlines mm-hmm. that we mm-hmm. have traditions that we miss
right.
over time. But
right.
then when we get back to them, we're like, why did we stop doing it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it carries forward the ideas in the cuisine.
Yeah. For those listeners who are not familiar with it, what is pomodoro sauce?
Pomodoro sauce is...
got through. But the pride in knowing that they're creating something that people love. I said, this is my favorite thing here. And she said, I made that yesterday.
And that's even with the students that I'm training in the pastry side of the kitchen. They're mm-hmm. usually in the dining room as waiters and waitresses. Mm-hmm. So they're able to walk through and present, you know, the dessert tray to the guest and say, guess what? I created this. This is what goes in this menu,
yes.
in this item.
Yes.
And they're proud of that because it gives them that sense of saying it's accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
For many students, they've maybe never touched certain ingredients mm-hmm. or put certain things together. And next thing I was like, wow, I did this now. They're
right.
really happy about it.
Right.
And when I get the review on the Monday after the weekly menus change,
mm-hmm.
I get a sense of what pastries have been selling, and I'll go in and I'll thank the class for doing what they've done. And next thing you know, they're like, wow, I didn't realize key lime pie was such a popular item. We sold out last week and we had to make more midway week through.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives a sense of having the students realize, guess what? You can get a sense of what customers want mm-hmm. in food by understanding what are they consuming.
Right.
And next thing you know, you can also look at your demographics of your students. So you say, guess what? As well as your students, as well as your public guests that are coming in, they have certain taste habits that they appreciate. I mean, rice pudding, bread pudding, tapioca pudding, that's of a generational age bracket.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But as you change it, now you start turning into things like a light mousse or a nice fresh fruit salad, something like that. It tells you about another demographic of age bracket that appreciate that type of food.
Right.
And so everybody has a different sense of what they want.
Right. Wow. It is really cool to hear about the students. I know I love to cook. And I ended up with an assignment after Easter dinner. But I turned it around. It was highly complimented. And it's such a sense of satisfaction.
Certainly.
It's this, because you don't, well, in my case, I'm not following recipes. Baking is a little more precise.
Mm-hmm.
Cooking is less precise. And we were talking about that Easter Sunday, where you start out with something and you add a little of this, a little of that, and it's like, no, I need more of this, or
that's
and
right.
and you make it until it's just right. And
sure.
there is no recipe involved. It's all about making it right. Your chef with grandma's pasta.
That's right.
There's love in that pasta.
That's right. I mean, he even trained our students how to make their own homemade ricotta cheese. And once one of our students said that, he goes, why do I have to go buy ricotta cheese? Why can't I make it home at every day? You know, mm-hmm. go home and make it myself.
Mm-hmm.
Once he saw it be presented, he's like, I'm going back home tonight to make ricotta so I can make lasagna tonight.
Okay.
He learned how to make pasta. Now he knows ricotta cheese. Now he got pomodoro sauce. Boom, boom, boom. He's got himself a dinner.
A beautiful of lasagna.
Yeah. And so the fact was, he's like, never again will I buy ricotta cheese in the grocery store. I'm going to be making my own ricotta
right.
cheese from now on.
Comes in a plastic container.
Yeah.
And all kinds
yeah.
of reasons not to buy it there.
That's right. That's right.
Talk about the bake sales. I know those are two times per year.
Two times a year we have a bake sale. We just finished up our holiday one for Easter / Mother's Day. And for many people, it's becoming tradition. Because the fact that for them, they might not want to spend time in the kitchen making pies during Thanksgiving weekend. So
mm-hmm.
they've gotten used to our pies, and they're delicious pies. They're reasonably priced, and people come and search us out. One of the hot sellers that was last fall was actually our mincemeat pie. For many people in this area, they can't find mincemeat pies because many of the bakeries don't make it. And I stumbled upon the formula to creating the mincemeat pie filling itself. And so I started manufacturing. I'm up to close to 200 pounds of mincemeat a year now, which is a lot of mincemeat pie filling to go through.
Yeah.
But we have customers that search us out, like, we've heard you've got great mincemeat pie. We want them. And next thing you know, they're buying 4, 5, 6 to take home with themselves. And they're freezing them away because they do freeze beautifully.
Okay.
And that's the thing, is if it's a pie that's solid in the sense of structure, it'll freeze beautifully. If it was fresh apple pie, made with fresh apples, it'll freeze up beautifully.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But things like a custard pie, that's something you've got to consume and eat right then and there. Even our cheesecakes are noted in this area. Everybody searches out the 5101 cheesecake, and
yep.
it's been made for centuries, you know, for centuries, for years now here at the college, and everybody wants that 5101 cheesecake. So the fact is people know about us. Last fall, I estimate we're doing probably 300-400 people in the week coming in for the bake sale. This Easter one was, this past one that we just had was a little slower, but it's only our second year doing it. So we're getting interest in it and people are starting to recognize, yeah, we've got another sale coming up. We want to get ready for the holiday.
Okay.
And it alleviates a lot of that pressure of going home and making, you know, fresh made bread or making a fresh dessert for the family and so forth. And it gives them the opportunity to say, guess what? We're supporting a program that's supporting our next generation to help support the change that's occurring in the metropolitan Detroit area. So our sales are becoming quite popular.
All right. What kind of items did you talked about the fall? What kind of items did you have for the spring sale?
In our spring sale, we stuck more towards some of the bread items. Some of the pastry items that we actually had were a carrot cake, traditional carrot cake log. Instead of doing it as a round, we're doing it as a log form, showcasing how to take a full sheet cake and cut it into smaller portions and be able to understand assembly work on it. We also had what they classified as a Seven Brothers cake, which is a chocolate cake, chocolate almond cake with a chocolate buttercream frosting in it. And it's a European buttercream frosting between the layers. So that became quite popular. And again, cheesecakes are standards. We did hot cross buns, soft dough dinner rolls. We did braided challah breads. So we try to touch base on different ethnicities within the pastry items, but also make things that people want to enjoy. And going back to having a lot of understanding with what the food is about and having our students understand, why is a hot cross bun so popular at Easter? Why doesn't it show up at Thanksgiving? What's the meaning behind it? And for many of them, they don't realize there's a lot of religious symbolism in pastries or in sweet items, as the sense of saying it's the rebirth of the season, it's the rebirth of the new year, and so forth. So for many of the students, when they start seeing things such as a hot cross bun, and I explain the reason why it's described as a hot cross bun, then they have another understanding of maybe I need to get back into church, or maybe I get back to my community. And realize there's a lot more to just making a product saying, oh, here's a hot cross bun. There's a whole symbolism behind it.
Right.
Even in the sense of saying even hard-boiled eggs, you know, they should be dyed red as symbolism of the blood of Christ. So these are all examples that people don't, we've lost connections with those.
Right.
And being able to give that back to our students that they start understanding it again, they'll carry on those traditions.
Okay.
That light keeps going on and off.
Yeah, it.
it's a spirited light.
Yeah, we've been dealing with that for a while. One of the other things I wanted to talk about was the recycling program. Both talking about things that are packages or paper or anything like that, but the food products.
Sure.
You have scraps. You have food scraps.
Certainly.
And I understand that's being recycled also into a mulch.
Well, that's right. What we're doing with the vegetable peels as well as eggshells and coffee grounds and coffee filters and so forth, they're actually being recycled into compostable items. And we're actually utilizing it as part of our composting program and part of our sustainability program through the American Culinary Federation. We have to teach our students about sustainability. And what that means is recognizing that at a point you have byproduct being left over. Could be food items. What do you do with them? How do you reutilize them? If you can reutilize them, if not, what do you do with them to either donate them to a charitable organization that can utilize them? It's just not throw them in the garbage can anymore.
Right.
And that's, that's again, another trend that's occurring in this industry to cut down the amount of waste that restaurants are generating or even grocery stores are generating. Because over the years, I've had the opportunity to read many articles about how much waste is going out of a grocery store, how much waste is being pitched out of a restaurant, and how people are surviving out of those dumpsters where they're actually traveling through the city and knowing what restaurants to hit on what particular night or what grocery store is throwing out certain things at certain times of the week. And people are making livings out of that stuff in the sense of saying they are surviving with that type of food. And so much of the landfills that we have throughout this country are food scrap related byproducts that could be recycled into more organic material. So for us here at the college, we are actually taking all those vegetable scraps that we are generating from peeling the cantaloupe, peeling down the watermelon and so forth, and grinding them and turning them back into organic matter to be put back on the earth. So that becomes part of our herb garden. It's enriching our soil. It's helping our vegetables grow much stronger, much more healthier. And so we're not throwing it into the garbage. We're actually cutting the amount of waste that's going to the landfills back down, which is actually, again, a win-win situation. We're paying for it to come in, but we're not paying for it to go out. We're actually putting it somewhere else that we can utilize it for the benefit of this earth.
All right. I read something a while ago, and this was just a general all-access dumpster that people had gotten into. It was a college project. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, 75% did not need to be thrown away.
Correct.
Only 25% of whatever was coming out of all these apartments actually belonged in the dumpster.
And that's the other aspect, too, like our cardboard boxes that we're getting products delivered into.
Right.
We're recycling all that, so that's not even going into our landfill. So the only thing that's truly going to our landfill is items that are not biodegradable. Mm-hmm. So all the cardboard gets reground, recycled, put into our newspaper, turned back into new cardboard boxes, sent back to us again. So we're recreating that recycled system. You know, reuse, reduce, reuse. Right. And that's an important thing to think about.
Yeah, exactly. Well, time passes so quickly when we do these things, and it is, I feel like the Mickey Mouse Club, it's time to say goodbye. So, Chris, thank you so much for being here today with Impact. And thanks to everybody who was listening to this show, because lots of good information, and we have lots of more good information coming at you on May 31st.
Right? Foodies on the 5th.
Foodies on the 5th.
Foodies on the 5th.
And keep in mind that there are four times per year when you have a fifth Tuesday, but they're not equal. It's not every three months. So our next one is May 31st. Thank you so much for listening to Impact. And the views and opinions expressed on Impact are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio, nor Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Jared Champion here. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Henry Ford College provides a strong foundation for students pursuing a career in education, offering a two-year associate's degree in pre-education as well as pre-secondary and special education. For more information about HFC's pre-education degrees, please call 313-845-6430 or check out the pre-education program guide at hfcc.edu/programs.
At any given moment, somewhere in America, a baby is taking a first step, a developmental milestone. But for too many parents, a baby's first steps aren't just a milestone. They're a miracle. These are the parents of babies who were born prematurely or with birth defects. It's a crisis affecting more than 500,000 babies in the United States each year. You can help them by joining volunteers like you who walk in March for Babies. The money you raise funds research and local programs that help babies overcome the challenges of premature birth and birth defects. Together, our steps make stronger, healthier babies a reality for thousands of families. Sign up today at marchforbabies.org to take the steps that help make milestones and even miracles